Good day, everyone. I first want to say that I feel honored to be here today. I gave my last talk in August 2020 in the midst of a life transition. At that time, I was adjusting to life in Vancouver after ending my marriage and moving from the Sunshine Coast the previous year. Since that time, so much has changed for me. I have found love, married, and moved to my new home in Kitsilano. Once again, I enjoy sufficient stability in my life and practice to be more active within our Sangha and to contribute more fully to it. And since I lack the oratorical skills of many other Sangha members, I will be reading today's talk, which I have prepared and written out. My talk today could have several titles, which happen to be the titles of two books that inspired this talk. One is Living in a World That Can't Be Fixed by Curtis White, a novelist and social critic. The other, an equally important one, is entitled So Far From Home, with the subtitle of Lost and Found in Our Brave New World. The author, Margaret Wheatley, a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner, has been writing, speaking, and teaching globally on issues of sustainability since 1966 and the need to step forward in our troubled times. At the core of this talk is the perennially Buddhist topic of impermanence. Ultimately, it is about me seeking and finding solace in the world just as it is. There is much talk today of saving the planet. It seems obvious that we live on an exhausted planet, one where human greed, self-interest, and coercive power continue to erode its very life force. I've been on this planet longer than most of you, and having grown up in rural Alberta, I found myself wondering when I first became aware of the peril of the earth. I had to ask myself, because my memory of life on the farm was that the work was hard and there was lots of it, but the land provided and we took care of it. Crops were rotated and every fourth year each field was left fallow to rest and regenerate. The only fertilizers used were animal manure. I needed to remind myself that this was a time when farms were labor-intensive family units, before Monsanto took over with GMO seeds, and before farms were consolidated into huge and highly mechanized agribusinesses that use copious amounts of chemical fertilizers, herbicides, and pesticides. Our current global dilemma is often packaged as recent news, even breaking news. However, it was over a century ago, still during the British colonial rule in India, that Rabindranath Tagore, an Indian author, cultural reformer, and the first Asian to win a Nobel Prize, gave us a glimpse of where we were headed. It was while the nations of Europe were doing battle during the First World War, 1914 to 1918, that Tagore urged his audiences in Japan and the United States to abandon political aggressiveness and cultural arrogance. His lectures, not always well received at the time, were chillingly prophetic. A pivotal experience in Tagore's life took place on a sea voyage in 1916 when he witnessed an unfathomable event that seems almost mundane to us today, an oil spill. To him, it was a jarring image of an earth destroyed by humanity's unbridled pursuit of power, now supercharged by the tools of modern science. In his 1917 collection of essays entitled On Nationalism, he writes, "Before this political civilization came to its power, we had wars, pillages, changes of monarchy and consequent miseries, but never such a sight of fearful and hopeless voracity, such wholesale feeding of nation upon nation, such huge machines for turning great portions of the earth into mincemeat, never such terrible jealousies with all their ugly teeth and claws ready for tearing open each other's vitals. Similarly, in 1932, in the gap between the great world wars, Aldous Huxley, the brilliant 20th century English writer, saw through the technical optimism of the era and created the dystopian world of his novel, The Brave New World, to expose it. He challenged the evolving society, one driven by absolute consumerism and ultimately sacrificing many human values. Sadly, our world did not heed the warnings from anyone. Instead, the technology and consumerism that had already established itself and unleashed swept over the world like a tsunami and solidly entrenched itself. In the interim, here are a few indicators of where we found ourselves. In the last century, 70 million died in World War II alone, including 150,000 from the nuclear bombing of Japan. The same technological advances and industrialization that gave us consumer goods, cell phones, etc., made it possible to produce weaponry on an unprecedented scale, and for those engaged in World War II to manufacture over 50,000 tanks for that World War. Since World War II, the number of countries with nuclear weapons has increased to 10, with a stockpile of some 14,000 nuclear bombs. A recent study of the cost of war at Brown's University reveals that all countries spend $1,700 billion annually on armaments and the maintenance of their armies. That's $1,700 billion. Looking back over my life, man's brutality to one another, the pandemic, and today's climate of xenophobia, sectarianism, and intolerance has weighed constantly and heavily on me. Maybe it's because in my lineage there are elements of pacifism and fear that I see the world as I do. My maternal grandfather, Vasil, emigrated to Canada from Galicia in western Ukraine and took out a homestead in Alberta. I remember him listening to the radio, announcement that a truce had been reached ending the Korean War. After clarifying that he had heard right because his English was not good, he began to sob with relief. I remember him saying, "Thank God they have stopped the killing." That was 1953. I was 9. Fast forward to January 1991. On television, I watched the United States Congress calmly vote to invade Iraq, launching their brutal Gulf War against Saddam Hussein. It was heart-wrenching. I watched in shock and disbelief and cried and cried. Both authors that I referenced recognize how solidly this brave new world is entrenched. To quote Margaret Wheatley, "We cannot change the way the world is." Quoting Curtis White, "We must learn to live in a world that cannot be fixed." Now, do not be discouraged. Neither suggests capitulation to the status quo, and both authors offer thoughtful and somewhat radical ways of living in and navigating the world just as it is. And we have our practice and the Dharma to guide us. Living in a World That Can't Be Fixed is a book about reimagining counterculture. Curtis White writes, pointing out how the 1960s counterculture has been derided and dismissed as both folly and failure. But he makes a far more important point that it was merely one manifestation of Romanticism rooted in what we call the Romantic movement in England of 200 years earlier. Reading from the book now, White writes, counterculture has been ridiculed for 50 years in the mainstream corporate media as something that belongs only to the 1960s, to hedonist, weed-toking hippies, to communes, and to the failed social agenda of the 60s. But counterculture was not the creation of hippies or of beatniks, Dadaists, decadents, or the turn-of-the-century arts and crafts movement before them. All of these movements were, however, countercultural in spirit. Counterculture, as we know it, is a creation, or better yet, an improvisation of the English Romantics, the first artistic and social movement to knowingly and deliberately drop out of its own world. After the bloody disappointment of the French Revolution, they were no longer under the illusion that nations could be fixed. So, instead of revolution, the Romantics simply withdrew from the dominant culture of early 19th century England. They dropped out of its rationalism, its industry, its obsession with business and trade, and most personally, they dropped out of the English class system and its social hierarchies. All of the subsequent movements inspired by the Romantics shared their sense that the world they had been born into offered only punishingly narrow options for life. They felt, as one author puts it, that if they stayed within that world, they had no choice except to grow up absurd, diminished in their own eyes as human beings, and diminished morally for aiding the larger purposes of their world, that is, poverty, oppression, and war. And so they improvised. There is a remarkable pattern in the biographies of the English Romantics. All rebelled against the plans that England had for them. Coleridge was meant to be a clergyman, Keats a surgeon, and Shelley a peer. Wordsworth looked in horror upon the prospect of quote-unquote vegetating on a paltry curacy. So they refused their station in life. They wanted to be poets with a capital P. But poet was not an approved role available to anybody, rich or poor. To say, I want to be a poet, was much like the young troubadour of the present saying, I don't want to write code for Google. I want to write songs and play in a band. The Romantics were war dodgers, blasphemers, and communalists, which is why they lived in fear of prison under the sedition and blasphemy laws that the Tories established after the French Revolution as a means of controlling revolutionaries, pamphleteers, atheists, and poets. There is so much more to the counterculture concept than there is time to cover today. I want to add that the book makes frequent references to Buddhist sanghas as successful countercultures. I quote, Buddhist sanghas, meditation centers, and countercultures of whatever stripe should continue to offer what so many are so grateful to find within them. Love, acceptance and an alternative to the corporate sociality of money. Margaret Wheatley's take is similar and yet a little different. First, she spares no effort in painting the grimmest picture of the current world and how we got there. Then she goes on to remind those seeking to make the world a better place to forget about succeeding, that is, to expect results from their work and be steadfast. Since the world cannot be saved, she presents an interesting notion of transforming one's identity from savior to warrior, and refers to a 12th century old prophecy from the mythical spiritual kingdom of Shambhala. The prophecy says, "There will come a time when all life on earth is in danger. In this era, great barbarian forces will have arisen, which will have unfathomable destructive power. New and unforeseen technologies will appear during this time with the potential to lay waste to the world. Warriors of the spirit would emerge on the soil of the barbarians, bringing about great change and healing through the powers of compassion and insight." Initially, I balked at the word warrior, imagining a person who goes to war, kills, and destroys. Movies portray warriors in life and death combat, aggressive or heroically depending against aggression. I relaxed when I learned that she was referring to warriors of the spirit. I realized that there were many peaceful warriors who came before me to emulate. They include Martin Luther King, Mandela, Tolstoy, Gandhi, Saint Francis, to name only a few. Now I will read a little from Wheatley's book. "The need to belong and feel accepted in the internet has driven us apart, creating lonely, grasping individuals, increasingly narcissistic and paranoid, but still compassion is in all of us. It takes dedicated warriors to remember this, to embody unshakable faith in human goodness, willingness to create the conditions so that people again can discover that acting compassionately is a true source of meaning and delight and the only path to survival." One of the most important lessons of my life is Buddha's teaching on impermanence and that everything constantly changes. The distinction of impermanence immediately made sense to me, and I quickly befriended it. Yet, for some reason, I found myself struggling with constant change, or the concept of constant change, or at least what I understood it to mean. I understood the dictionary definition of change, which is to replace something with something else, especially something of the same kind that is newer or better. Substitute one thing for another. Meg Wheatley uses the word emergence instead to express change. Replacing the word change with emergence explained more clearly that change doesn't just happen or cannot be made to happen. I prefer emergence because it conjures many things occurring at the same time, many factors coalescing, enabling something else to emerge. I have gradually come to accept that I do not have to change the world. I only had to follow the precepts and be the best bodhisattva I could be. This realization gave me solace, a sense of liberation. Now, I will read you a haiku, one that I wrote during under Kate's guidance during one of her talks. How old is real old? Body creaks and aches. Wisdom emerges. As time goes on in my personal world and the greater world, I notice a more tender appreciation for the precious gift of being alive, and maybe some wisdom wanting to emerge. I sense a growing longing to live and love more fully, and leave this earth awash in rich relationship and with minimal regrets. I am grateful for my practice, one that allows me to see and embrace this world with all its beauty, its pain, and its suffering. I am especially grateful to all of you who share this wonderful counterculture, our Sangha, with me. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for listening.